It's Rake the Moon, episode 17. God-awful in Grimsby, crisis in Cleethorpes, lousy round Lincolnshire, and enough of any of the A16. Here we are then, set up for Saturday's playoff eliminator, where we'll have Spyrite sitting on the Stratton Bank. How has it all come to this? That's the only real topic we could possibly have for Rake the Moon. But before we steal ourselves for game 46 out of game 46, I'm going to allow you to preen Sam by partly dismantling the banter section this week, because at the time of recording, your head is clearing from an evening at the glamour of something I've never attended, the Sports Journalists Association Awards. You may not have come back with a gong, but how was it?
it was an interesting evening talking to like-minded people in the industry. There probably are maybe too many sports journalists, was what I generally took away from the evening, packed into the London Palladium bar pre-show. It was an awful squeeze, and yeah, you can probably understand why people say that there are too many of us when you look at it a bit like that. But it was a really good evening. Really proud to be able to take Moonraker to an event like that, and I'm taking it as validation of the project as a whole, to be sharing a platform with the individuals that are there. And it was it was a really, really good evening, really well run. A worthy winner in Alex Miller in Sheffield for his coverage of the unfolding shenanigans at Hillsborough over the past year or so for the regional title that I was in for. Overall a really good and enjoyable experience, and hopefully we can go back again next year and go a little bit better.
The most fascinating tweet I saw was that Mark Goldbridge got booed. Did you boo?
No, I didn't. I think there's an interesting confluence in sports media at the moment between those who have big gone out in sort of content creation and YouTube and stuff like that, and it's feeding in, I think, partly quite rightly into these awards, and because the universes are merging, and everyone's trying to establish what the best route forwards is for those who want to do maybe what we might call old school journalism, but in a new era way. And I think that there are different tiers to journalism and content creation and sports entertainment that are all coming together. And I think the fact that there are so many new awards in that list that are coming up show that the industry is trying to grapple with what is now in its orbit, which has a lot more comets and stars than it used to do. So, yeah, I think it's all about evolution and adapting. And those of us in what we might call legacy media who are capable of adapting for this new age are the ones who are going to be successful. And that's what I'm trying with Moonraker and with Counterpress. So, it doesn't surprise me that some people don't like certain things, but it wasn't for me to be doing that.
Very, very, very diplomatic. No, and I think the stunt peg video of Swindon, for example, that seemed to get a lot of traction. So there is kind of room for individual creativity and coverage, I think. The whole Goldbridge phenomenon is probably one we could also break down in a separate sports media podcast and take every bit as long as this episode of Rake the Moon is about to do.
Quite possibly, and you always think, is that kind of model exportable beyond the very, very biggest clubs? Is it something that you would have lower down and you would see value in it? And I think for me personally, the answer is no. I don't think that those shows, to me, provide sort of value, but they obviously have entertainment within them, and they have an audience for them. So whether or not we like them, they've got a place. They've earned their place in the current media environment because they produce something that people want to watch. And regardless of whether I or other people like me in the industry disagree, it's just a reality of it. And we are now bedfellows, so we need to find a way to evolve the industry together.
Indeed. Well, I would like to see the stunt peg meme involving her putting her hand over the letter S very much back in vogue, because we've not seen enough of it in 2026. Okay, on to game 46 we go. We'll be right back. Well, I guess perhaps the fact I've immediately tried to sprint us onto game 46 does indicate quite what we all thought of game 45, really. But the Grimsby defeat does need some dissection, I think, because Swindon have an awful long way to travel in terms of psychology and performance this week if they are to beat Chesterfield and book their place in the playoffs. I'll allow you to give some armchair analysis, Sam, and then I'm sure at some point I'll have to discuss what it was like in person.
Yeah, well, you and 900 others got to experience exactly what we didn't want to, but I think what an awful lot of people kind of expected as well, which is a bit of an indictment of Swindon's current situation and a considerable worry, given that they've only got one game left against one of the other form teams in the division this weekend. So, yeah, from my perspective, which was increasingly cowering behind the sofa, it was, I think, probably similar to those that had vantage points behind the goal at Blundell Park. And that was, as soon as that tackle went in from Will Wright, I immediately thought, game over. And I think that that is a really worrying position to be when you're watching games regularly, and you feel that even the most the sort of slightest blow against a team that is in form and has momentum has the capacity of knocking this team off completely. And so it proved. And I think that first half defensively was diabolical. Going forwards, it was meagre, it was disjointed. There wasn't a lot after the first 10 minutes, which were relatively bright. There wasn't a lot that or it was to worry about from a Grimsby perspective, and it was all just really rather easy for Grimsby, and they loved it, didn't they? And I could feel Ian Holloway sinking into his chair during the second half, because that would have been for him personally one of the worst experiences. I think you try and compare it in the future to that defeat at Colchester way back in December 2024, and I imagine that those two will stack pretty much alongside each other for him personally. For the club, it's obviously not good, and they've only got one chance left. But it lacked anything, really, didn't it? It lacked skill, it lacked communication, it lacked teamwork. And just everything went wrong. I've called it a calamity casserole this week. And that is, for me, the best way to describe it. There were so many individual mistakes, so many collective mistakes. Three of the four goals were utterly avoidable. One was absolutely world class, but three of the four were completely avoidable. And they very rarely showed any sort of likelihood of troubling the goalkeeper at the other end. So, yeah, in terms of bad days at the office, that one ranks pretty high, low, whichever is the correct word to use in that situation. What about you? Was it worse than that description from being there in person?
I don't think I can pick any fights fundamentally with the performance from that description. But I think the Schadenfreude did feel a little bit more evident in person. They were having the best time, the time of their footballing lives, in a sense. The Grimsby fans handing out or seeing their team hand out a beating to their managerial nemesis, I think, added to the occasion. I think I've got one word on it all that keeps sort of coming back into my head, which is kind of scrambled. I don't know how Swindon looked quite so scrambled so quickly, from the passes that they couldn't find for each other. Just some kind of collective glitching, almost. And I think that's the most sort of alarming thing about it, really, was the complete sort of lack of functioning of almost everyone, kind of individually and collective. I feel some sympathy for Aidan Borland. What a 19th birthday that was, maybe. But, I mean, other than that, You could see some little kind of things in him that I thought you could see, but yes, it was just not only losing, but how it just sank. That's the overwhelming thing that makes me think it is such a challenge to try and put it all back together and almost start afresh for game 46, which sounds ridiculous, I know.
Yeah, well, how do you go about doing that? I mean, this conversation in this episode kind of merges between the two, because it's a formidable challenge that faces both Ian Holloway and his players this week to be able to disconnect from what just happened and the inevitable backlash that has followed, and to pull themselves up, puff their chests out, and go and produce a performance in front of what's likely to be around 12,000 people on Saturday that is good enough to get 3 points, get them back in the playoffs against a team that is right on form themselves, will be very confident in securing the draw that they need to be there. He's obviously trying a few things to do that, and we can talk about how he might do that this week. But, you know, it's not an easy week, particularly with the distraction of the sponsors' dinner in the middle of it at a time when maybe, ideally, they would want to have a clear week away from the pitch as well, because managing their time not at work will be just as critical as to managing their time at work. There's lots of things that they can try and do to shift mindset, but fundamentally this team is, as I mentioned in my piece, it is not waving, it's drowning, to quote a famous 1950s poem from my GCSE English anthology. I think that there is a real problem in confidence there, and there's a problem in rhythm and structure and missing key players who add so much, not just tactically, but motivationally as well. I think that they are going to have to somehow flush everything, rinse it down with chemicals, make it sterile, and then try and find a seed of positivity and optimism to start the week. So, I mean, if you're Ian Holloway, how are you going about that, Andrew? What do you do on Monday? He said he was going to have what would you have done on Monday? He said he was going to have a clear the air conversation, but I mean, clearing the air in this situation is like trying to rid London from its smog in Dickensian times. I don't really know how you go about clearing that air. So if you're in charge, what do you do?
Well, I don't know if you set up intra-squad boxing or something to let all the frustration come out. It does almost feel like it requires one of those eccentricities of a sort of Brian Clough or earlier era. I'm not even sure paintballing is up to it. But I do think you might have to try something that takes them out of perhaps sort of being locked entirely in the football, whether it's, you know, be it the training or whatsoever, and perhaps focus more on getting some kind of emotional glue back together, really, to get them to, you know, maybe feel the way they did about themselves earlier in the season. Maybe you go back and do the old video montage trick of digging out some of the better hits of different parts of the season to remind themselves what, you know, how they can play and who they can be. I think for the actual game itself, shameless plug coming up for my alternative employer, we should have a ex-footballer sports psychologist coming on at some point to give us a bit more clues on that. And I think some of it is kind of all that sort of kind of staying in the now and perhaps not trying to let the enormity of the game grip you and you know, perhaps you do a bit of greatest hits and then you just try and prepare for it as you would for any other game. Maybe you go the other way and try not to make them think too much about how it all comes down to this.
Yeah, I mean, that would probably be my chosen method. Just try and create fresh environments and fresh ways of thinking about things. I guess he's tried that in moving training, so that, you know, the majority of sessions will take place at the County Ground this week. And part of the idea behind that is that change of scenery to give them a different sort of focus. And it's definitely a grander focus, you know, to play and train in that stadium rather than on council pitches, you know, 25 minutes down the road. I think that there is something to be said about that. Plus, of course, the surface is just brilliant, and Matt Povey and his team deserve the award that they got there for the League Two Grounds Team of the Year for it. And that will help, I guess, in theory, in their preparation from a physical perspective, though I don't think that the pitches at Beaversbrook are quite as bad as some people would maybe have you believe. But certainly the Counterground pitch is better, so maybe that will aid with those coming back from recovering from injuries and those who are managing injuries. It'll be interesting to see how he manages the weeks for Ollie Clark and Joe Snowden, for example, and how he balances out his natural reluctance to play someone necessarily who might not be able to deal with the physicality of a game when they're coming back from injury. Because realistically here, he's got to gamble. If he's got any chance of these players playing, he needs them to be involved. So does he risk Ryan Tafazzoli, for example, who's been absolutely chomping at the bit to play, but has been, protected, because playing with a broken arm is probably not the most sensible thing to do. And I'm not sure you get many doctors advising you to do it. But do you reconsider this based on the fact that it is win or bust? I think there are loads of really curious decisions that he's going to have to make tactically and formationally and from a personnel perspective. And that's an area that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. Like, if you're the boss, do you risk players that otherwise you would ordinarily leave out for a game that is in this particular circumstance?
I think with the fact you do have the five subs if someone breaks down, and the fact unless you win, there are no games to preserve yourself for, it does kind of push you that way. I can't quite imagine myself. Well, first, I can't really imagine myself saying no to an angry Ryan Tafazzoli. But second, I can't really imagine you can possibly play with an arm like that, and yet you feel you need him to just kind of desperately see if he can bring the thing back together and give some leadership, really. And I thought it was interesting in the sort of interview afterwards. Obviously that was a very humbling experience for the manager, given all the connections with Grimsby, but you don't hear him doubt himself very often. When you more hear him talk about, I have my 1,000 games, and he has seen pretty much all circumstances, good and bad. So I don't know whether there's also something during the week that has to kind of help him where he goes to sort of reassert his own confidence, really. But I think to come to your suggestion, if there's someone there who's beyond 50-50, I'm probably like shoving them out there and hoping for the best and trying to take consolation from the fact the bench can be used. If you get 45 minutes out of Clark, I think you probably do it, don't you?
I think you have to, and I think he'll want to play as well. He was obviously with the group up in Grimsby, and I can imagine, having sat through and watched what's happened to his team there, he will be itching to be involved if at all possible. And obviously there might be a case for Joe Snowden being available as well, Darren Oldacre too. All of these players do bring something. I think that Oldacre in particular gets a bad rep, as we've talked about previously, because his body language naturally does not suggest that he's putting in the effort and the distance that others do, when actually in reality he is. But having as many players available to him as possible is obviously going to help how he sets up, not necessarily his starting 11, but how he sets up to be able to manage a game either from in front or behind will be critically important, because he wouldn't want to be in the same situation he was in against Accrington, where he opted for a bench without really any sort of defensive support from a midfield perspective in particular, and ended up with a late goal being conceded for a draw. So he's going to have to also suppress that desire to have as much attacking intent on the bench to be able to change a game if behind. And I think they've got to go into it not in that state of mind. I think there's got to be, we've got to go out, we've got to get in front, we've got to get further in front, and then we've got to stay in front, rather than, okay, well, as long as we have enough in reserve, then, we're never going to be quite out of the game. I don't think that I don't think they can really risk the idea of falling behind in this game. I think that will suck any life that is in the stadium out of it. And there is always going to be the danger at this match that if things go wrong early, that the ground will turn on their own team, which obviously would not be helpful in the instance, but would be understandable in the wider context of what's happened over the past 4 months. So I just hope that he sets out with intent, not trying to manage the game early and then win it late necessarily, but take the initiative, get the team going, get the crowd on side, try and make the buzz. There's going to be about 10,000 home fans, I believe. I think that that's got the potential for go either way, depending on how they do in the opening half hour. So I don't think he can risk a slow start. So I think he needs, in this particular instance, to pump his most energetic, most informed players into the starting lineup and see where it goes from here. But I don't know, maybe you disagree.
I think that's an interesting one. I suppose I did have the thought kind of going through my head in contrast. You don't need to win it in the first minute, but I am kind of going with your argument that you have to help the crowd a little bit. Because everyone, there cannot be a sort of afternoon without anxiety, I think. You know, no matter how hard people try to come in with a positive mindset, which I'm sure they will, at some point, if it's, you know, nil-nil, whenever, people are going to get stressed. So it's, but I would think it might be valuable to have a couple of the more traditional finishers still as finishers, perhaps. But it's very difficult. So, you know. I'm not sure what you do with Will Wright at the moment, because he looks to be a little among the more scrambled side. But you have to have a round in the squad, perhaps in the way that he wasn't at Accrington. And of course, if you want to know how to win a pressure match, I guess you could always get Richard Wood to go in and give the team talk after the after the ladies' triumph in their winner takes all match with Moneyfields, which they went and won, of course. So congratulations to them. We should, before we wrap things up, mention there is a certain amount of disquiet about Chesterfield being given the sort of Stratton Bank part of the ground, but there is a degree of context to this.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of comments on this. I did briefly do a piece last week just to try and explain it, but it's not always picked up and people aren't members, so they don't necessarily read. But I think it's important to recognise here that there are some sort of nuances to how many tickets the club is obliged to give if requested by the away side, and how the current sort of capacity breakdown of that part of the ground sits. So Chesterfield are entitled to, under EFL rules, 10% of capacity, minus some elements of segregation. I think the capacity is roughly around between 13.5 and 14.5 at the moment, depending on recommendations for safety and other segregation and bits like that. So they would be entitled to maybe 1,400 tickets if they requested that. And they did request that because they sold their first 1,000 very, very quickly. And so therefore the club needed to up that. I believe that the allocation in the corner of the Arkle stand, it can take about 1,100. It certainly can't take 1,400. They had a game against Birmingham last season where they had a few more than 1,100 in, I think, and it was too much of a squash. So they have to open the bank in that situation. They can't open the whole bank because of some elements of safety and also that screen that's sitting there as well. So they wouldn't be able to open the whole thing and fit all of the Chesterfield fans onto that. So they kind of have to split them between the two. There's no way you can get them further down the Arkle stand because the segregation block is in place and there's got self-contained facilities, toilets and food concourse and all the turnstiles, etc., are self-contained for that away block. So when you have to give 1,400 plus and there's no other option, then you have to open both. Once you've opened the bank, you might as well get as many Chesterfield fans as you can in the bank, hence why they've ended up giving them an allocation of just over 2,000. And I believe they're going to be pretty close to selling that 2,000. I think initially there was some concern that they would only sell a few hundred, and that might have risked a bit of a loss on that stand, given some of the, you know, temporary facilities and the extra stewarding and stuff like that that has to go on. But it sounds like they're going to be selling pretty close to that allocation. So they're going to be back by 2,000 fans. And I think one of the big takeaways from going to Chesterfield, or when the team went to Chesterfield, and you would have been there, Andrew, was how much noise they made regardless of the game situation. And it did feel like that was a fan base that was willing to back the team whenever, didn't have the sort of same nerves, anxiety, recent despondency that Swindon supporters have dealt with. So you can imagine that 2,000 of them on the road in a game like this are going to make a lot of noise, and there's going to be a little imperative on the Swindon fans to not get lulled where possible into that sense of worry, which again feeds into why I say that he needs to pack his team with players who are going to make a difference early on to try and bring that crowd on side. But that's, again, that's a bit of a different conversation. The main bit that we're talking about is there is nuance. It's not just driven by a need to earn money, and ultimately there were very little other options that were on the table once Chesterfield had requested 10%.
I can't remember the last time I looked at that screen either, but that's possibly a side issue for another day. I think so. I'm not quite sure how we wrap this up.
Well, how positive are you feeling, Andrew? Do you think that they have the capacity to do this? When you take that microphone at 2 o'clock, 2:30 on Saturday, will you be doing so with hope, or will you be doing so with apprehension?
I have to say, I've kind of driving back on Saturday, it would have been entirely apprehension. I barely might have got past the H on hope at that point of view. I guess a little distance away from that makes you think it's possible, but you know, the onus is on them to win. The pressure is all on them to win. And I think it just goes back to that sort of scrambled nature of the performance. If the, you know, the changes to training, and if the kind of, as you say, a quick dispatch of that game to the septic tank can be done, then maybe they can do it. But I do think that I've peeked at the bookmakers' odds, and essentially their belief is that Chesterfield are going to do it. So, you know, it's anxiety. I have to say, it is anxiety at this point.
I think what I really hope is that either it's a runaway win, which would be great, but just that they keep themselves in it till the last, even if they end up losing, so that they can keep the crowd on side throughout, you know, that it's not becoming a toxic environment. What we really don't want, because it will affect the players, and I know why people will be feeling like that, but if they are down a couple of goals with 20, 30 minutes to go, that environment is going to be horrible. You know, I'm expecting the owner to be at the game as well, which could well create a bit more of that sort of tension. And I don't really want that. That's not the way you want to be ending. So I hope for the sake of the players and the coaching staff, because as much as we can criticize some of their decisions and some of their performances over the course of the season, they pulled 75 points out of the season. It's been a very competitive, if not high quality, division that they might fall towards the end, and it will be quite a remarkable fall and quite a remarkable failure if they don't do it. But they are still human, and they have still spent 9 months of their lives trying to create success at the club. And I would hate for it to end in a ball of bile. So I just want it to be close, to be tight. You don't often get these sorts of matches in the final day of a season that carry weight like this and have the potential to have so much drama. And we sit through really bad seasons for days where there is something riding something that could be positive riding on the match that's in front of us. It's an opportunity for the fans, the players, the manager, even if it's just for these 90 minutes, to be collective and to show a sort of universal purpose, even if it doesn't come to fruition. And then at the end and through the coming months, we can analyze what's happened, if it has gone wrong, and conduct a post-mortem and see what will happen next. I hope that it doesn't get to the toxic level that I do fear would be the case if they slipped up early, found themselves in a difficult position, because that would be a very sad way for a very sad few months to finally come to an end. So while I do not go in with any hope or expectation, I'm hoping at least to be able to experience an event, you know, even if it doesn't go the right way, that is, it's what we watch all of the dross for, is to experience a bit of passion and emotion and possible reward. So yeah, let's just hope that there is not, that it is competitive, and even if not enjoyable, that it serves the sense of occasion that it promises.
Indeed. I suppose before we do an inquest, even though before the body is cold, which I fear could happen, as you say, I think if they were to draw and miss out on the playoffs with 76 points, that would be exceptionally unlucky. I think in terms of the points needed to get into the playoffs as well. And I can't think of a result that has essentially gone the way they would like in the last fortnight, really. On reflection, God, I don't know if I wish that, Grimsby had won against Chesterfield, then our lives would be a lot easier all of a sudden. So 'tis not to be. And at least, everyone, we're not Barnet. So there we go. Congratulations on your big win and scoring 5. You're not in the playoffs. Thank you very much. There's always someone slightly worse off than you. Anyway, I will go and I think have a lie down with a cold compress and just wait for Saturday to come round. Thank you, sir. But before I do that, I should, of course, encourage you to subscribe to the Moonraker for the princely sum of £5 a month for all of Sam's coverage. And if things go well, no doubt there'll be an extensive playoff preview to look forward to. If not, no doubt Sam has got the post-match inquest and post-season inquest all in hand, haven't you, sir?
Oh, yes. I'm not going to predict. I was almost saying it's going to be the playoff preview. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say it. But yes, everything is in hand, depending on what happens Saturday.
Thank you very much.